21-0978 in the matter of the welfare of the children of AD, B, and DMD. Council, although we are appearing versus Zoom.gov, the rules are very much the same as they are in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask you to introduce yourself at the beginning of each time you speak, because we are recording this and making the recordings available on our website. And when you are please leave your videos on for the attorneys during these arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Jennifer Thompson. I'm the attorney for appellant Doyle Dent, who was the respondent father in the underlying Child Protection and Termination of Parental Rights action. There are two issues at play in this appeal. First, whether the termination of Mr. Dent's parental rights was supported by clear and convincing evidence that the child was neglected and in foster care. As stated in my brief, the district court did abuse its discretion in finding that there was clear and convincing evidence, as there was very little record laid at all regarding Mr. Dent.
Ms. Thompson, if I can jump in here, and I know you're prepared to start with that, but if you'll indulge me, and we could flip the issues, perhaps, because I'm curious about the reasonable efforts issue. And if we were to conclude that the district court erred in making the finding or the determination that it did, am I correct that we would be reversing without having to address the clear and convincing or sufficiency of the evidence on the factors regarding neglect?
That's correct, Your Honor, because reasonable efforts and a statutory basis are both required for termination.
So, and I'll leave it to you, but I'm more focused on that issue this morning. But if you wanted to put me off until the end of your time, feel free. But the state of the law, as I understand it, is that in Minnesota, the court has to make a determination that reasonable efforts were either made or that reasonable efforts would be futile. So it's a finding or determination of either reasonability or futility. And in addition, if a court were to make a determination that reasonable efforts would be futile, that would be a court order that would be required in order to relieve the county of its obligation. So in this case, the court makes the determination that because of his incarceration status, quote, the services offered to Mr. Dent, or the incarceration made, quote, the services offered to Mr. Dent reasonable. So as I understand that, and so the first part of the question is, do you agree that in this case, the court did not make a finding of futility, but instead made a finding of reasonability, that the efforts made were reasonable?
I do agree. And I think that the respondent tries to take two bites at the same apple, if you will, to argue that the district court did find the efforts were reasonable under the circumstances, which is part of where I get into the clear and convincing evidence argument. But then also the respondent argues that efforts were futile. To begin with, the determination that efforts are futile is something that's made on a prima facie basis at the filing of the petition, not after trial. So to rule after trial that they were both reasonable and futile doesn't make sense. They contradict each other. It's sort of like a panacea to try to cover all angles possible to make sure that it sticks. But the provision of reasonable efforts, as the statute says, always required upon a determination that a petition has been filed stating a prima facie case that, and it's subparagraph 7, the provision of services or further services for the purpose of reunification is futile and therefore unreasonable under the circumstances. So here the district court found the efforts reasonable and the respondent argues that they were futile. Neither of them. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I have a question about this futility. Now, my use of this phrase, nunc pro tunc, will probably take you all back and show how long ago it was that I went to law school. But when I read that sentence, the lack of services provided to Mr. Dent to facilitate reunification, you know that one, I read that as kind of a futility finding, kind of in a nunk-pro-tunk. Wouldn't you say that's like nunk-pro-tunk then as it is now? I'm telling you now, this. If you brought this to me, County, which they should have, if they were going to make the argument, but I would have found futility. So could you address that for me?
Certainly. The agency didn't make that argument early in the case. And all along to say, well, they were counting on that the district court would find the efforts futile in the future. They didn't lay the argument prior in the case that the court could make that ruling. So they were obligated under the statute all along, regardless of the later ruling, they were obligated all along to make those reasonable efforts because they were never relieved.
Here's my follow-up question then. I mean, if we assume that the county should have, but didn't bring this argument, and therefore the district court erred in the way it handled this, why couldn't that error be harmless? I mean, isn't it your position, your client's burden to show not only that there's error, but that there's substantial prejudice demonstrated? And when I read kind of the next part of the court's finding about, you know, his history of violating protective orders, that sentence would not be likely to bring about lasting and parental adjustment enabling the child's return. It seems to me you could argue what the district court here is saying, look, there's not prejudice from this. Shouldn't we respect that?
Actually, given that the termination of parental rights is a fundamental constitutional right, the termination, any minutia that is missed is harmful. It is prejudicial to the decision. And I apologize. I was looking for the case reference, if it was TAA or TR, where the court found that such an error was indeed not harmless. The agency, the respondent, relies on TAA, TR, and Wildy to contradict this argument. In fact, I point out, go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
In TAA at 710, while the case does quote the statute, there it was chemical dependency treatment that was the reasonable effort issue on appeal, but the termination wasn't based on drug use. So the district, and in this case also, the district court had made extensive detailed findings to support a failure to comply with a case plan. That is not on point with this case. It didn't happen. In Wildy, futility is not even addressed. The ability to provide physical and financial support for the child is addressed. So neither of those arguments supports that. And indeed, you know, when it is a fundamental constitutional right at play, and there is an alternative resolution of transfer of permanent legal and physical custody, then the missing determination is harmful and prejudicial.
I mean, let me ask this, if I may. You conceded the best interest factor in this case. Is that right?
I did not argue it, but I did not concede it.
At least, okay, it's not an issue in this case then.
Correct.
Did the appellant ask to be made a party to the CHIPS case?
To my knowledge, counsel for the appellant did not ask to be a party. He was the presumptive father and a participant. So as a parent, was entitled to counsel in a case plan.
And did he have counsel?
Yes, he did.
Did they make any argument or ask for a case plan?
Throughout the pendency of the case, Your Honor, I can't comment on that. I am not certain.
How would that not be a forfeiture if he was had counsel and didn't ask for it?
It's required by statute without request. It is compulsory for the agency to provide that.
But if he doesn't ask for it or object to it, how is that not forfeited?
If he doesn't object to not getting a case plan,
mm-hmm.
And I can't speak for who his court-appointed counsel was at the time, but I'm quite certain that Mr. Dent had no knowledge of the statute, and I know that ignorance is no defense. However, the agency is well aware of its requirement, and well aware of its obligation to provide a case plan for every parent. So it's difficult to waive a right you don't know you have. So I would argue that he simply didn't have the knowledge, and I can't speak for counsel. That may have been the case for counsel as well.
Ms. Thompson,
I'm just trying to analyze what would have been done differently had there been a case plan, because the child's been out of home for a considerable period of time. So, and will continue to be out of home in foster care for at least another, looks like 10 months. And so how do you think a case plan would look here?
Sure. The case plan is a statutory requirement. What it comes down to is whether a termination was appropriate, and holding the agency accountable to its obligations to ensure that a termination doesn't happen. A case plan could have provided an opportunity for mental health assessments, a parental capacity assessment. It could have availed Mr. Dent of services either in the facility or in the community that could have improved his ability, a domestic violence counseling course, if that's the allegation that he couldn't overcome domestic violence. All of those things could have improved his ability to parent so that when he is released, he can maintain that relationship. The difference here is that the agency always has the option to transfer permanent legal and physical custody to a relative unless there's egregious harm. They always have that option instead of termination of parental rights. And the default in so many places is to terminate and place for adoption when that TPLPC, pardon the acronym, is available. So rather than strip Mr. Dent of his fundamental right of parenthood, the agency could have transferred custody and still given him the opportunity to parent out of prison with the help of a case plan.
So Ms. Thompson, if I may, Judge Smith, first of all, are you finished
with
line of questioning? Okay. Speaking for myself and not for the panel, I do adopt it. There were errors made here by the agency, and those are troubling to me. But would you agree that we have applied a harmless error analysis to errors in TPR cases? You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
That analysis
has it been applied? And so that's why I want to specifically ask you, what is the substantial, as explicitly as you can, what is the substantial prejudice that your client has demonstrated here?
The substantial prejudice is, and I've argued this in other cases, so the citations are buried deep in my server. The
Ms. Thompson, just speaking for myself, I'm not asking for citations right here. I'm just saying, what's the prejudice? What was that service he could have had? What was that could have happened here to your client?
Again, the fundamental right of parenthood, the close relationship between parent and child is completely stripped by a termination. Had he had a case plan and been given the opportunity to follow it or fail at it, he wasn't given that opportunity.
What services would he have gotten? Would it have been visitation in prison? I'm just trying to be as specific as you can be.
Absolutely.
What was the prejudice?
Domestic violence counseling, courses, evaluations, parenting capacity assessments, a domestic violence inventory, all the psychological assessments, even classes, you know, that he could have taken in parenting a young child or parenting a child as they age into adolescence, various services. Even if visits were not available to him, there are video visits. He testified that he had an established relationship with his child before he went to prison. Also, he testified that the reasons he was incarcerated were not for anything having to do with the mother or the child or the OFP in place for them, but rather a separate stalking charge for someone completely outside of their relationship. So even in a family case, he would not have been precluded from a parenting plan based on that conviction. Yet the district court used that to sever the relationship completely. And that's a substantial prejudice as a parent to be stripped of your any future possibility of having a relationship with your child and the ability to parent.
Thompson, what do we make of the lack of any assessments, right? So sometimes you have most times you start with the assessment, then you have recommendations, and that becomes the basis for the services that a county is required to then provide. But if we don't have an assessment, we don't even have any contact, much less an assessment, much less services here, right? So what do you make of our ability, if you will, to say that we will affirm and interpret this statement as a futility finding if we don't have services identified because there was no assessment done?
I think the futility finding cannot be made because the prima facie case wasn't made or found to be made. Further, the even providing assessments would have been efforts, right? As you said, they result in recommendations. The issue here was it was a foregone conclusion. Dad's in prison. He's not getting out until permanency debt timelines have run. So we'll terminate on him. He's got a bad history. So the assessments weren't even given for that reason is my interpretation of the case file. And without those assessments, no services could be offered. I mean, Your Honor is exactly correct. So it goes back to even offering the assessments prior to even making a recommended case plan. Nothing was done from the get-go.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. You'll have additional time for rebuttal. We'll turn to you, Mr. Moen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Patrick Moen, Assistant Stearns County Attorney, arguing as counsel for respondent Stearns County. Now, I know from the get-go, this case is not a shining example of customer service. It's probably not a good example of best practices. However, the lack of a case plan and the lack of any meaningful services proactively offered by the county do not justify reversal of the district court's order. Even if this court were to find that the district court committed error in handling this reasonable efforts issue, such error is harmless.
Well, let me start with that question then, Mr. Moen, because what do you think the remedy is for an agency that fails to produce a written case plan as required by statute?
I think that needs to be handled on a case-by-case basis. I do not agree that that should result in a compulsory reversal or remand.
You probably know the law as well or better than I do on this point, but there, you know, we have a published case from 2018. The syllabus says, quote, a county does not satisfy its obligation under the statute to make reasonable efforts when the county fails to produce a written case plan. And the county is not excused of that obligation by a father's opposition to participating in a case plan. So we have, in my view, I don't want to say an automatic remedy, but sort of a de facto rule that if you fail to provide the case plan and you don't follow that requirement, according to the syllabus, that's the end of the determination for our purposes on reasonable efforts.
I think logically might make sense, but functionally it overlooks the background context, facts, and the situation of the case and the parties.
I guess I'm asking then, are you saying we should disregard this case?
Well, I'm not suggesting it should be disregarded in entirety, but I think that there's certainly room to interpret it that perhaps even as a matter of equity, if you will, that it might be in certain cases, and I argue this is one of them, applying sort of this compulsory remedy of reversal or remanding the case to not really be in the interests of justice or certainly in a child protection matter where the overarching concern is the best interests of the child, to not look at the facts of the case and conduct an independent analysis, keeping in mind that, yes, there is this legal and statutory requirement for the county to provide a case plan and to provide reasonable services. I think there are many examples out there, and certainly the ones that I cited predate that, but They are examples where no case plan was developed, that no efforts were expended. However, this court or the Supreme Court of the state has said and ruled that under the facts of that particular case, that we will affirm the district court's order terminating.
What I have difficulty understanding is how did the county attorney's office not ask the court to make those findings or to develop a case plan? It seems fundamental that a case plan should address all the possible parties, and it didn't in this case, and I'm troubled by that, although I understand your argument about best interests, but it just, we can't allow these cases to go on without a case plan. That just seems so fundamental to the whole process.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, for lack of a better phrase, it didn't happen. And I don't think that there's any excuse or justification I could offer here, aside from within the context of this case, that TMD's mother, Ms. Bedford, was the legal custodial parent. Appellant had no legal custodial rights to TMD. So within that framework, all reunification efforts were focused at Ms. Bedford.
Oh, that's an explanation, right? And I think you're correct to point to that as an explanation, but in terms of whether or not that is, and you can see this under either part of the argument, whether that is enough for clear and convincing evidence or you could, as I see it, more on the reasonable efforts side, primarily, that doesn't excuse the county. It might explain what happened, but that doesn't excuse them. And we still have to decide, do we affirm that determination or not? And I'm still struggling with this because of the case I mentioned, right? And that was a case where the parent was incarcerated. We held that circumstance doesn't change what qualifies as reasonable, or it might change what qualifies as reasonable, but it doesn't excuse the county from making reasonable efforts. And essentially, that's the argument you're making, is that we are now after the fact, not in a prima facie stage, but after the fact, excusing the county's failure to provide reasonable efforts. And I, that's the part I struggle with. So how is it that we can make that determination of futility when the court didn't do it at the right time, the county didn't ask for it, and the county didn't make reasonable efforts?
Right, and that's a difficult situation to be in the sense of, in hindsight, absolutely, 30 minutes, an hour's worth of work to make a couple phone calls to the prison to arrange services. I fully agree that the fact of incarceration alone should not excuse the county and does not excuse the county from engaging a non-custodial incarcerated parent.
I think the remedy isn't the remedy what we did in that other case where you reverse the termination. And then if the county, they still have the opportunity at that point to engage with the parent and bring another petition.
I think in certain cases that absolutely that makes sense. I still argue that there's room to interpret that 2018 case, apply that to the facts of this case, and call it error because that's what it was. The county failed in their obligation. However, that error was harmless for a number of reasons, and affirm the district court's order.
Are you asking us to make a finding of futility? Or are you saying that the efforts were reasonable?
I think that the more correct finding is that any efforts would have been futile and thus not required. I don't think there's any efforts realistically I could sit here and argue to even ask this court to find reasonable.
So is there any case law that where an appellate court has made a finding of futility in the first instance? And I don't mean to put you on the spot, Mr. Moore, if you don't have something like right off the top, because it is an odd situation. I didn't see, and in my experience, haven't seen a case where most of the time this futility argument when it comes to us on appeal is something that was made below. And there is a court order relieving the county of its efforts. And then after that, we are reviewing that decision, the court's order relieving the county of its obligation. So we don't have that in this case. And it may be that this is odd in that sense. So if you don't have something off the top of your head, I understand, but I didn't see it. And I was curious if you have found in your research a case where this court is for the first time determining futility.
Well, I don't think as clear cut as Your Honor is framing the issue. I think that more of the issue is the county's duty to make reasonable efforts, but that doesn't require efforts that would be futile. So the district court found that any efforts would have been futile.
But that's not what the district court found. Unless you can point me to that finding, that the statement from the district court, and there is a distinction, and maybe Judge Jessen's point is well taken here, that you know we can say that that it's a distinction without a difference, but there is a distinction between saying the efforts were reasonable because of incarceration and saying efforts would have been futile. Those are different things. And the district court didn't say futility. It said the efforts were reasonable, which begs the question, is it ever possible for a district court to say efforts are reasonable when no efforts have been made? Is no efforts ever reasonable efforts? Right? That's why I have a hard time saying that this is a distinction without a difference, but what is your take on how we can take what a finding that these efforts, no efforts, were reasonable and affirm that as a finding of futility? Again, after trial, we have this procedural irregularity as well.
Right. No, I fully agree with Your Honor that they are two distinct ways of looking at what had happened. And right, the district court did use the phrase in its findings that the efforts were reasonable under the circumstances, but really there weren't any functional efforts at all put forth by the county to engage appellant. And I can see Your Honor's point that, well, then you get kind of into this circular argument that are reasonable efforts, or if efforts are deemed to be futile, then those efforts are reasonable. And if there are no efforts, however, in those no efforts,
if the question had been futility, then the district court could have squarely addressed whether or not an assessment, psychological assessment, chemical dependency assessment, whether or not the types of domestic violence programming that might be available to Mr. Dent, given how much time he has left, and maybe there aren't any. I don't know, right? We don't know what the district court would have found if it had asked a question of futility. And it's possible that given when his release date is, he'd be on a wait list for 6 months or something and wouldn't be able to qualify for an extended program of dependent chemical dependency treatment or something like that if that had been recommended. But we just don't know because the district court didn't ask that question. And what we have is after the fact, a finding of reasonable efforts. Right. So it's hard to say that had the district court asked the right question, it would have come out the same way and terminated under futility. Right.
Correct.
Mr. Moen, let me ask you this. If this court determines that the failure to provide a case plan lack of a futility finding was an error, which was not a harmless error, is our only option to reverse the TBR, or is there some other option that we should be considering when looking at remand?
I think upon remand, what might make sense would be to initiate a separate child in need of protection or services case, specifically naming Mr. Dent and having an opportunity to develop a case plan and give him the opportunity to comply or not comply, and then as appropriate, proceed to a permanency option, such as a transfer or such as a termination of parental rights proceeding again, if that is the case. But I do think under the facts of this case, where Mr. Dent was incarcerated, where there was a protective order in effect for 2 years, where Mr. Dent could not have even had contact legally with TMD. He was in prison for that felony stalking offense, which in fact was against Ms. Bedford. And given those circumstances, I think that that justifies the district court's ultimate conclusion, even though in hindsight, as we discuss it here, it kind of comes about it the wrong way by framing it as reasonable efforts. But the respondent does respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's order terminating appellant's parental rights.
Further questions from the panel? Then Ms. Thompson, we will turn to you for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Moen brought up the point that Mr. Dent had not had established custodial rights. And there is a distinction between custodial rights and parental rights, obviously. He maintained his parental rights. As far as custodial rights, he had brought an action in the district court to establish custody and parenting time. So he was in the course of that when the ex parte OFP was filed. And anyone who's touched family law for a moment knows that that circumstance can be suspicious, that the timing of OFPs following custody petitions is not uncommon. I wanted to revisit
what- Ms. Thompson, if I could jump in there, because I think that the no contact orders or those limitations, putting aside incarceration, that there might be other circumstances here that limited what services could be provided, right? It seems that Mr. Moen is asking us to look at those. And based on those other circumstances, including no contact, OFPs, and the stalking, that is a sufficient way to justify what the district court did. My question to you is the universe of services, right? How much of this universe of potential services, understanding we don't have assessments, how much of that universe is still available in light of the no contact or other limitations apart from incarceration?
So if Mr. Dent were in the community, what would be available to him? Is that the question?
Even incarcerated, what's available to, what's the universe of, so incarceration is, as we know from the ARB case, by itself, not enough. Incarceration plus no contact is potentially a different circumstance. So I'm asking what universe of services are still available given those things, because Mr. Moen says there are no services.
Well, the OFP expired in November of last year. So presently, Mr. Dent is allowed contact with the child. And I would say again that the services of domestic violence inventory and potential counseling, psychological assessments, et cetera, potentially medication. You know, if we have a psychological assessment that shows he has some mental health issues that could be medicated, there's the universe of services available. Whatever the assessments would show are needed are available. Again, with that OFP expired, he could be starting having supervised visits now.
So is there support in the record to support what you just said? Because maybe this goes back to if there's your client's obligation to establish that any error is harmless, you know, so where can we look to say, okay, here's where we can say are services that would be available to him in prison?
Is there anything in the record that shows that? Your Honor, I highly doubt it because the agency didn't explore those services. That's the best answer I can give. If they didn't explore what's available to him, the record will not reflect it. I could go and do current research now to tell you what's available at the facility, but the record won't show it because the agency didn't explore it. Going back to the definition of reasonable efforts, a reasonable effort to finalize a permanency plan is due diligence by social services to reunify with the parent of removal, and I'm obviously summarizing from the statute here, to assess the non-custodial parent's ability, and if they cannot provide care, to provide services to enable the non-custodial parent to safely provide care for the child, to conduct a relative search, which leads then into subparagraph 4 is regarding sibling separation. And then paragraph 5 leads to, if the child cannot be removed or returned to the parent of removal to finalize permanency with adoption or transfer of permanent legal and physical custody. So again, his rights didn't have to be terminated to bring permanency to this case. Had all of these reasonable efforts for a permanency plan been made and a relative search done, the siblings also could have been kept together, is my understanding of the record, had that all been done. But a termination of Mr. Dent's parental rights wasn't necessary in this case. And I argue that the agency didn't take the steps to justify terminating his parental rights. Thanks, Your Honor.
We thank both counsel for their helpful arguments in this challenging case. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue opinion will be issued within the statutory time period. And with that, we have come to the end of our oral arguments this morning, and the court is in recess.